Space Radio for the Seeker.
And welcome. I hope you're doing well today. Thank you for joining us as we continue to investigate theories and facts, history and prehistory, in search for answers and deeper questions to ask. I'm Henrik, and on our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, you can find much more programs, videos, commentaries, films, and also headlines, news from around the world. Neil Sanders holds a Master's of Arts in Film Studies. He studied psychology and media production for his Bachelor's of Arts honors and is a qualified hypnotherapist. Neil has been researching the history of the dark art of mind control and its application by military and government intelligence agencies across the globe for years. He is the author of the two volumes, Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, and that's where our discussion is going to lead today. So stay with us for much more on the mechanics and history of mind control. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Neil Sanders. Thank you so much for coming on. I've seen some of your videos here in the past couple of months, actually, so it's good to finally talk to you. Thank you for coming on, Neil.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
So tell us a little bit about your interest in mind control. I mean, I know that you go far and wide in many of the different subjects that you do, touch upon, and of course, the scope of mind control. We're going to get into some of that, but what's the origin of this for you? Was this a draw and a pull for you, Neil?
I sort of got interested in it off the back of the Manchurian Candidate film, really. That sort of piqued me. But at university, I studied psychology, but then I also did some semesters on advertising and media construction and sort of editing and that sort of thing. And I started to notice there was a lot of sort of cross-contamination between the disciplines and in areas that you wouldn't really think of. For example, just something as simple as the use of color and the use of fonts, or the positioning of a camera, for example. For example, you know, if we're going to zoom in on somebody's eyes and they're going to look to the left and the right, then we know that this character is particularly shifty. But these are sort of based on psychological instincts and such like. And then I started to notice that a lot of things that you wouldn't notice, for example, the colors are very important. A good example is sleeping pills, for example. Sleeping tablets are usually pink or blue because there's something within the human brain that associates those particular colors with a calming, soothing effect, whereas particularly powerful medication is often red or red and black or red and yellow because it highlights sort of a danger sort of element. You know, you can see that in nature with animals, really. But then when I sort of saw that I was introduced to the Manchurian Candidate by a friend when I was quite young, and I started to notice a lot of the offshoots of it, the connections, I mean, with obviously Frank Sinatra, who ended up, who was friends with Kennedy and had the film pulled because he felt that it was a little bit too close to the truth shortly after, the JFK and then later the RFK assassinations. And right. Frank Sinatra, you know, he had connections obviously through the mafia and sort of like that, and Camelot was the court of Kennedy. And then these other sort of more tangential things, like, for example, Angela Lansbury, who's obviously a main character in the film, her daughter, Deirdre, or Diddy Lansbury, she actually wrote her a personal note and signed it because she was about 16 at the time. She was a member of the Manson family. And then tangentially, obviously, the Manson family, they didn't, but they were involved with the death of Jay Sebring. Jay Sebring just so happened to be the cocaine dealer for both Frank Sinatra's crowd and the Kennedy crowd, and he actually dealt to Marilyn Monroe as well. So, you know, you find all these sort of things. I was also a big fan of the Beach Boys, and I started to notice Nick Grillo, who was their manager. This was all connected with the Manson thing as well. He was a mafioso, and the Brother Records and, you know, Paramount Studios were essentially being used to launder drug money, and this connects with the CIA, obviously, allowing the mafia to deal in certain areas and stuff like that. And you just find that nothing's quite as simple as you ever thought it was. And then you just, you know, find layers upon layers upon layers, and you keep pulling at it, and you find that there's a very, very seedy underbelly to the world.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. it's funny with like the 50s and 60s, that period as well, and in how much actually is out in the open as they really are beginning to investigate this and bringing this into, you know, the mainstream more, and the, you know, the tentacles of this beast, if you will, seems to be out there much more in those days than it is today. It's much more covert. I think it feels like it's more technological today. But in those days, it was right there. It's almost like kind of a romanticized period. But the question is, obviously it is as bad today, if not even worse today than it is then. But to me anyway, Neil, it feels like this period is where the documents lie, you know, where most people still can kind of get real tangible hard evidence that this is where what was going on at the time. So it's more difficult today to dig this stuff up, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's only so much that you can find, I'm afraid. I mean, the point is that at the time in the 50s and 60s, it was certainly covert. It wasn't until sort of 1977 that documents started to come out. I mean, there were talks about two things. There were talks about this clandestine entity known as MKUltra that was sort of spoken about in hushed terms, which was obviously the CIA and American military industrial complex mind control program. But in the 50s and 60s, the concept of mind control was prevalent with regard to communism. There was a real push to get this idea of communist mind control, and then that would be the reason that the Americans had to go in. And this all came from a guy called E. Howard Hunt, who your listeners probably know. He's the guy that confessed on his deathbed to, you know, he was involved with the Kennedy assassination and the Bay of Pigs, and he was a Watergate burglar. And he also worked with Frank Sturgis, who worked with Jose Podermo, who was the doorman who probably shot John Lennon, but that's another story. But anyway, he released a book called Brainwashing in Red China, and this laid the foundation, the social ideologue of communist and Chinese communist brainwashing. And this is really where the sort of Manchurian candidate sort of stemmed from, this concept. And obviously there was also the show trials in Russia where people were confessing to certain things. But mind control essentially falls into four categories. It's truth serums and trying to sort of extract information. It's wiping people's memories so that they can't give away information. It's control of their thoughts or their actions to create what would be known as a Manchurian candidate. Or alternatively, the fourth, which is far broader, is propaganda, perception management, and social organization with the use of the media and organization of social trends and designating norms or manufacturing consent would be the academic term for that.
Yeah.
And so I mean, these things were prevalent in the 50s and 60s, and they are still prevalent now. I mean, just an example of an attempt at manufacturing consent at the minute is the beating the drums of war that's going on in certain media outlets and such like that, and framing of Assad as a dictator and a monster. And it's regardless of how much truth there is in it, it's a tried tactic. It was done against Gaddafi. It was done against Hussein. It was done against Khomeini. It was done against, you know, and it goes back to, I mean, you can track it right back to, I'm sure it's as old as civilization itself, but basically when it was being organized officially was during the First World War, when they were framing Kaiser Wilhelm as the butcher of Berlin and putting around stories that they were chopping off the arms and legs of babies and raping women. And then, you know, we got that story that the mass rape involving Viagra in Libya and all this nonsense. And it's the same trotting out of the same sort of stories, because essentially it works. Do you know what I mean? If it's not broke, don't fix it. And if you can pull on people's heartstrings and manipulate them and you know, take them in that direction, then you can sort of mold them, or you can make them more appeasable to action. And then another sort of way of doing that would be you know, just keeping people in line either with sort of aspirational lifestyles or stuff that you can't possibly, stuff that is taboo. For example, in the 50s, you know, they talk about this sort of as a rose-tinted time. But with the sort of McCarthy era and stuff like that, the fear of communism, Reds under the bed and all this, and there was a sort of palpable terror then that you could be exposed as a secret communist and then you're done for. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So there's always these mechanisms that run through society that allow those who wish to do to basically be in control and to shape people's direction.
And today we have Al-Qaeda. Anybody can be a terrorist, right? This is the new threat, you know?
Exactly. I mean, there's numerous things. I mean, it works on... Someone asked me yesterday, actually, is it a conscious thing? Is it a subconscious? Is it an unconscious thing? And it works on many levels. I mean, consciously, everybody's just got the day-to-day. You've got to feed your family. You've got to get to work. You've got to put up with rubbish from your boss. You've got to, you know, you've got to toe the line, fly right. You know, you can't do everything that you want to do. There's the concept of money. That's a stressor for a start. Which obviously advertisers prey on. I mean, this is another thing. Everybody have the aspirational lifestyle. Mortgage your house, do this, get a bigger house, a nicer car, get all this stuff on tick and whatnot. Get credit cards because those products will make you happier. And it's oxymoronical because basically the stress that you're putting yourself under in order to sort of achieve that never quite their goal is That's the end in to itself, because the more that you buy, the less satisfied you feel, so the more you need to buy to fit in with the alpha males that are being portrayed on the television, you know, the Kardashians and all these people, because you want that lifestyle. Everybody, even if you despise these people, you would look at it and go, yeah, but it'd be much better if I didn't have to go to work and I was a billionaire and, you know, obviously I wouldn't be as facile as these people, but it would be nice. And so there's all these on a conscious level, and then on an unconscious level or subconscious level there's, as I was saying, techniques within the media to position using colors or using words or anything just to, you know, to make people feel fear or to make people feel worried or, you know, at the minute they're really pressing home this concept that a third world war might kick off.
Yeah.
That is a stressor, isn't it? You know,
oh, sure.
So that's on a subconscious level. Again, whether there's an element of truth in that or not, these are all mechanisms of control. And people need to realize that one of the biggest figures, and I'm sure, you know, I'm preaching to the converted here, but the media and politics, it is very, very rare that anything actually goes out in the media that isn't meant to go out. Even when sort of politicians get sort of found out, and you know, the scandals and such like that. Certainly within British Parliament, there's an entity called a whip. What a whip does is they're kind of like prefects within Parliament. It's their job to know everything, to just know everything and to sort of foresee any problems and to, you know, keep people in line and such like that. They you know, essentially, politicians are just frontmen. They don't really know the job. They're moved into the job. They're not an expert on that particular field, and then they're left to do it. Essentially, Parliament's run by the people that have always been there, the civil servants, and I mean, do you get Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister in your country?
I've actually seen a few of those. Yeah, it's a good example, you know.
To be quite honest, it's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And you know, but because of this, there's no way that these sort of scandals, that the 90% of these scandals could exist. So when they do come out, it's on purpose. I'll give you two examples, right? Okay. One, Frost died recently. David Frost, Sir David Frost,
died that's right.
Very recently. And one of the most famous things was obviously the Frost-Nixon interview, where he exposed Nixon and backed him into such a corner that he basically incriminated himself. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that was scripted. That entire exchange was scripted by the White House and the Pentagon. Sir David Frost was in on it. Nixon was in on it. The entire scenario was engineered to position Nixon as looking foolish, to make the general public believe that they got one up on him, and to make him feel duly chastised.
Yeah.
You can take that a step further, actually, because essentially the Watergate scandal, I mean, there's two elements of that. It was exposed by Woodward and Bernstein. The film's All the President's Men. It's Dustin Hoffman and Rob Redford. And they exposed the fact that the president had ordered this burglary and blah, 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 blah. It comes to pass, basically, that Bob Woodward was actually in the employ of the CIA. He was an asset of the CIA. And so he was really there to sort of lead Carl Bernstein away from the more juicy elements of it. According to people like Alex Constantine, one of the elements that they were supposed to hide was the fact that Nixon had actually got a sort of what could be termed a death list. He was essentially seeking out enemies that either on the left or on the right that could be either a rival to him or a potential problem politically. And so the entire escapade of the Watergate burglary coming out was to essentially cover up elements of the Bay of Pigs and also, you know, Nixon's nefarious behind the scenes dealings. Another example that I'll just give, just to show how sort of closely tied they are, this was. We have this terrible rag in England called The Sun, and it's basically a right-wing tabloid, and it's just very magazine-like, but it's incredibly popular. And they tend to sort of play on themes like fear of immigration and stuff like that. Not as badly as other papers like The Express and The Mail, but basically they tend to sort of go that route. And there was a story a few years ago, a campaign by The Sun, that basically we're very concerned about the number of illegal immigrants or asylum seekers that are coming to this. I mean, that's one thing that they always confuse the two, just to make sure that no one's got a coherent argument. But they were concerned about this, and they had a campaign and loads of polls and stuff like that. And it was so impressive that the Home Secretary David Blunkett actually deigned to go down to The Sun, look at their information, and then set policy based on The Sun's findings. Brilliant. So everyone who reads The Sun thinks two things. The Sun's brilliant. B, this is the way that we actually get action and people are finally listening to us. And C, you know what, that David Blunkett's all right because he's actually listening to us. Well, it comes to pass, I forget the name, it's in my book, the name of the journalist that discovered this, there's a thing called the Downing Street Grid. And a Downing Street Grid is basically, it's a plan of the upcoming few months, press releases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost like, you know, a diary of public appearances and such like that.
Right.
On this grid was the entire plan before it happened. The plan to have the campaign in The Sun, the scripted interview of how Blunkett would react to The Sun, and then basically how they would play off in the media that The Sun was very, very forthcoming in making for this policy go forward. So the entire scenario was made up. It was all manufactured to make everybody, for the reasons that I just said, you know, and everybody was essentially sold a pig in a poke.
It's like a rigged, you know, WWF, is it? Or WW whatever it's called, you know, one of the wrestling matches over in the States.
Yeah,
and people are sitting in the audience believing that this is the real world. And it's, you know, now and then they of course throw someone to sacrifice them to the wolves. Because it's good to have that perception that, oh, look what happened to him when he, you know, if he steps out of line, there's people there and there's systems in place to catch these crooks, right? You know, so
absolutely.
Despite this, there's no authenticity. It's a completely scripted reality. And this is how you obviously, at the end of the day, control and manage not only public opinion, but the whole game. It's like we're in a synthetic bubble that has no, you know, touch with the real world whatsoever. What would you say is the benefit to doing it this way?
Well, the benefit to doing it this way is that basically it's coercive and it's covertly coercive. I mean, it goes back. The first person that did it in the modern era was Edward Bernays. So again, I'm sure your listeners are very, very sort of savvy with
sure.
Him and a chap called Ivy Lee invented the concept of the press release. And basically Ivy Lee presented it and then Bernays sort of honed it. And the first one that he did is very famous. It's called Torches of Freedom. He essentially created a false rally in, I think it was in Times Square in New York, where a load of very attractive young ladies, all on his command, whipped out a Lucky Strike cigarette and smoked them. Because at the time, it was very, very taboo for women to smoke in public.
Yep.
And how it was framed was, these are torches of freedom. This is an act of feminism. This is a fight for equality. This is akin to throwing yourself under the carriages. You know what I mean? And it was done in such a way that the photographer and everybody was in on it, but it was presented as an organic story. Now everybody sees this and goes, "Oh, fantastic! This is a bit of news. This is a cultural event." And furthermore, you know what? I might take them up on that offer. You know, if it's good enough for those women, it's good enough for me. I'm going to show my independence by smoking. And as it came to pass, the entire thing was an advertising and marketing campaign commissioned by Lucky Strike Cigarettes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good story. I mean, that shows the inception right there as well. And also how all the people are involved in this. And then the press release then has basically become, instead of having as a media outlet, an active, you know, core, if you will, of reporters that are ready to actually, you know, go out on scene or even to a certain extent, you know, find the story. They're sitting passively waiting for the release from, you know, the White House or politicians or what have you. So it's a very non, you know, engaged manner that things are being run these days.
Well, I mean, it's about the concepts of manufacturing or engineering consent. I mean, these are academic sort of theories. One is Edward Bernays and one is Walter Lippmann, and they're essentially the same thing. If you can create established norms, if you create established normal behavior and patterns of being in society, then essentially you can control people. And Lippmann took it a stage further. With this concept of creating the people, creating the pictures within people's heads in order to inform public opinion. A very basic example is like, if you've never seen a lump of gold and somebody describes a lump of yellow metal as gold, and then you go and find a lump of brass, say, which is yellow metal, but you have no concept other than gold, you, for a time, you're going to act as if you've got gold. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So who creates those pictures? You know, for example, where do you get the concept of a terrorist? It's not an organic thing. It's come through a slow drip feeding of Hollywood and the connections of Hollywood to the military-industrial complex. Because again, people don't realize this, but if you want to use military hardware in a film, you've got to get the permission of the military. Like, you know, if you want to use their equipment, and they'll say, yeah, you can use it, but we want to get final rewrite of it. And so films like Transformers and TV series like JAG and Iron Man and all these films are written, they're scripted by the Pentagon.
They have their own overseer of the scripts, I think, and they run through them and they can basically edit.
I mean, at one time it was George Tenet that was doing it, who was former head of the CIA, and the guy that's doing it at the minute, I can't remember, but this is a CIA liaison. There's a very good book about it called Operation Hollywood that actually sort of talks about it.
Yeah.
But again, this concept, it's not new. It goes back to sort of, Roman and Greek times where they had traveling players, and basically they'd come in and it was compulsory that everybody had to go and see the news, and they'd tell you about what was going on in the rest of the world. And this was the only place that you get your information, and it was all authorized, like, you know, like the King James authorized version and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? You've got to frame people's reality so that you can then. It's a very simple thing. It's like a scientific experiment. If you know how people are going to respond to stimuli, then you can direct them, basically.
And I think it's also, I mean, if we go back to those times and imagine people, let's say, that are maybe not actively in the city, you know, or a civilian in the Roman Empire, what have you, a quote unquote country bumpkin or whatever, out on the outside of the gates, if you will, of the city, etc. So if there are people basically that are coming out there to give you the news and to tell you the stories of what has happened, etc. I think that people at that time, equally today, have an opinion that this is, why would anybody lie about this? That's not in their frame of mind. Like, why would someone just show up and tell you a lie? If something's happened, they tell you what happened and that's it, right? It's very simple.
Well, I mean, an example that could be tracked to it today is if you live in the sticks, I live kind of a bit out of the way, basically. You'll have an informed opinion about the big city, and it will be one of two things. Either the streets are paved with gold, or don't go to the big city, for God's sake, because you'll have your shoes stolen from you. So, but where have you got that sort of idea from? And where a lot of people get it from at the minute is television, because television is essentially the traveling player of today. I mean, people actually put their children in front of, you know, it's a babysitter.
Yep.
That's where a lot of people get their information from. But and there's a concept called cultivation theory, and it was developed by two guys called Gerber and Gross. And essentially what they said was, the more you watch television, the more likely you are to believe the reality of television. You're more likely to believe that the world is actually like it is portrayed on television. And say an example of that is, because it's often really grim and stuff, and if it bleeds, it leads, and sensational and violent on the television, that people that watch a lot of television tend to think that the world is a lot more violent and scary than it is. Or, you know, people that tend to watch a lot of television tend to have ill-informed views about certain religions or certain, you know, sexualities or anything like that, because they're basing it on what they've got. Do you know what I mean? It's not really a criticism. Doing what they can, and these systems are as old as civilization itself. So,
well, I mean, you're right there, because if this is your only reference to a certain subject, and if you're not actively going out and finding, you know, either contradictory information or trying to verify it or whatever. This is just how the mind works, right? It is going to form with the information that it has available. And this is, of course, not a conscious process per se. This is just like automatically happening. And then people have this other idea consciously that, no. I know it's TV. I know it's, I'm not, you know, it doesn't affect me. You know, I'm not influenced by ads, you know.
We're flattered into sort of apathetic placidity at the minute, because you're told constantly that, I mean, again, there's several ways of doing it. Do you get clip show? I'm sure you do. There's always a clip show on, usually on a Friday night on Channel 5 in England, and it's like, remember the 80s, or 10 things I hate about the 90s, or shameful secrets of the 70s, or, you know, look at this old tomorrow's world. Look at the way they thought that the 1980s, they thought by the 1980s we'd be driving in flying cars and stuff. They're so stupid in the past. Not like today. Oh, no. We're more informed today. Obviously, we were idiots right up until this second, but now we're very well informed. And I couldn't possibly be tricked, because I've got a million internet sites, I've got 17 newspapers, I've got all these television channels, I've got all these different nodes and stuff like that. I'm informed. There's no way that I could be tricked. I mean, look at the way that certain products, basically, they sell a lifestyle. Apple, like iPhones and all that garbage. Which, by the way, is a brutal, grim company. Like, aside from the fact that basically they're now saying, well, why not use your thumbprint as a thing? Get lost. If Steve Jobs walked up to me and asked me for my thumbprint, I'd punch him in the face. Like, but people are going to quite happily give that without a second thought.
Yeah.
And, you know, regardless of this is a lifestyle thing, you know, it's wonderful. You can see the geniuses at the Apple store and stuff like that. And at the same time, that piece of technology in your hand that costs about £300 costs about 40 pence to make. And the people that make it are slave labor, essentially. It is slave labor. And in Foxconn, which is where a lot of it is made, the workers are made to sign a contract that says if they kill themselves due to the hard working, their family is fined. And if their family can't pay a fine, their family goes to prison.
This is a way to combat all the suicides that was, ramping in the Apple Village for a while there. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, these are monstrous organizations, but you don't see that. You see the sheen and the glamour of it and stuff like that. And again, this comes down to things that I'm sure, again, your viewers, your listeners, are very, very aware of: cognitive dissonance and consensus trance. And cognitive dissonance is essentially doublethink, and it's the same thing with consensus trance. The cognitive dissonance, as I'm sure you know, is where basically people just two completely opposing viewpoints don't really work together. They'll do the mental arithmetic to make it work. Like, for example, oh, I'm still going to be a fan of Jimmy Savile. I don't care, blah, 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 all the good that he did. I mean, he was a monster. Yeah, but, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the concept of consensus trance, it was, again, a psychological premise. A gentleman called Charles Hartley came up with it, and essentially it's like a mass hypnosis. It's like the best analogy is the Emperor's New Clothes. Imagine if you were stood there in that crowd, and they're all gazing adoringly as the Emperor walks past, and you suddenly notice that actually the big flabby pale guy's naked, but you don't want to be the person to mention that, because if you mention that, everybody else, the embarrassment of it and the shame of having to admit that, yeah, we're all going along with it, weren't we? You'll be the one that is attacked. And that's essentially consensus trance. People don't like to be pulled out of their world, because if you start pulling on one thread of the tapestry of your existence, you suddenly find out that actually it's not as secure as I thought it was, and all these premises that we hold to be true aren't true, and all these institutions that are basically there to protect us, they're not there to protect us. We're in a relationship very much like a pimp and a prostitute. And it's this fear and this total fear and control that keeps you subservient in the system.
Yeah. The Milgram experiment, you know, there's a number of these things that
Zimbardo,
are there.
Zimbardo, Solomon Ash, all of these experiments. Like, they basically show that people can be coerced into doing things just basically on the premise of authority and the premise of getting rid of the responsibility yourself and just not wanting to rock the boat, because people are generally nice. You know, this
well,
is
exactly.
The
you know, but at the same time, you know, at the same time, Neil, what I feel here is that we have there is a situation where a lot of people are also, you know, in that way trying to get off the hook, but they are the one. I mean, there is a lot of vicious, you know, wolves and sharks out there, and they're you know, highly intelligent. They know exactly how to, you know, coerce the people and utilize it, you know, rise to the hierarchy at the top of this, you know, ladder, again, basically. That- but at the same time, just want to say that at the same time, you have a the reason why that has happened ultimately is that you have a bunch of people that are willingly taking part in propping that person up and, you know, supporting their work or coming to them for the information, what have you. It is a slave, you know, master kind of relationship that we're in.
It's not just that, Henrik. It's more than that. It's because of the consent of the world.
Yeah.
You can act in a certain way that is monstrous. You can quite happily destroy the lives of several thousand people if it's a good business decision. And if you were to argue against that, you'd be told, grow up. Grow up. This is the business world, Neil. This is dog eat dog. Okay? We've got more concerns than you. We're working for the business and the customers, which is total lies. But, you know, you can justify doing something as monstrous as making hundreds of families go without, you know, possibly leading some people to suicide. And you can justify that. Not only can you justify that, you can feel proud of it because you've done well for the company. And not only is that not a bad thing, you can feel proud of that in the construct that is created within the business world. You can stand up and say, look, you know, greed is good, grow up, man up, you know, all of these cliches and stuff like that. This is good for the business. Fundamentally, in the long run, this is a good thing. The ends justify the means. And a million other cliches. But that's a mind control program because that's not a normal, compassionate way to think. Your thinking is skewed by other structures. And you know, it's second nature. I mean, that's where that phrase comes from, the concept of doing stuff that you've learned behavior, like driving, say, changing gear. You do that by second nature. That's not a natural instinct to do. And in the business world, you're being trained to have a second nature. And, you know, it's... That's the way that the system works. I mean, this very much ties into sort of the hippie movement, really, because you've got a certain strata of people within it that have that are going to find that quite distasteful and such like that. So you need to give them things to look for, and either it's, you know, heroes and stuff like that, musicians where you can vicariously rebel or vicariously succeed or such like that, or alternatively these academic things like critical theory, and it's where essentially you sit there and criticize and go, this is wrong with this culture, no, this is wrong with this culture, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and I know better, but don't actually do anything about it. And that came from the Frankfurt School, and so one of the things that came out of the Frankfurt School was Herbert Marcuse. He wrote One Dimensional Man, but he also wrote Eros and Civilization. Eros and Civilization was an academic text that basically justified having a lot of sex with a lot of different partners, and it politicized it and justified it. But again, in the same way that the music was there to move people away from politics and towards mysticism and drugs and ineffectual avenues, so was sex in the free love movement and the hippie movement and the flower generation, whatever you want to call it. And but again, these are designated and organized structures that basically have been thought out and planned.
Now I want to ask you more about this, you know, obviously LSD, the MKUltra sessions, the hippie movement and all that. If we back up for a little bit though, I want to ask you a little bit about what your take is on how to break that cycle, if you will. If we back up a bit, you have a bunch of individuals basically participatory in a system then that they're not, you know, happy with, or it doesn't, you know, fall in line with their beliefs, what have you. There has to be an individual disconnection from this type of behavior if a person doesn't want to, you know, participate in what they're doing. I think the problem there is that we have a majority that is sitting around and waiting for the majority to do something about it.
It has to be an individual thing. I mean, one thing is that a lot of people just don't want to do it, and I'll come on to that in a second. But I'm going to use a sort of a terribly inelegant version of a Chinese proverb. A guy goes to the temple and sees one of the monks and says, look, I want to be enlightened. I want to be like you. He says, oh, brilliant, that's excellent. Go and please do my garden. And so he does, and he cuts himself on all the thorns, and it takes him 10 hours, and gets sunburnt, and he goes back exhausted later, and he goes, okay, I've done that. Can I be enlightened? He goes, yeah, of course you can. Go and clean my house. And he goes, all right, brilliant. And he scrubs his knees and takes all the skin off his knuckles, scrubbing all the floors and stuff like that. And he goes, okay, right, I've done that. It took me 6 hours. Please let me be enlightened. He goes, okay, fine. Go and get my cows in. Please go and get all my cows. And he does, and he takes him forever, and the cows trample him, and he breaks a finger, and he comes back and he goes, okay, I've done that. Please give me the key to being enlightened. And he goes, all right, brilliant. You see that waterfall down there, the one that basically crushes anything that goes beneath it. It crushes all the rocks, and it crushes all the cliff face beneath it. I want you to go and put your face under that, please. He goes, I'm not doing that. That's stupid. I'm not going to do that. That's going to destroy. That's going to kill me. I'm not doing that. And the monk turns to him and says, brilliant, you're enlightened. Now go. And that's the point. You've got to come to it from your own perspective. And you've got to not really look for sort of cult leaders or anything. You've got to take on board and then sort of see what's right for you, because it's an individual journey, basically. And what's you know, what may be right for you may not be right for some, different strokes, etc. Yeah,
that's right.
The reason that a lot of people don't want to do it is it's two concepts. One, which is essentially the culture industry, and one which is Skinner box. B.S. Skinner is sort of the father of behaviorist psychology, and that's essentially where we get our education system. It's behaviorist. It trains people like an animal, like you would, you know, like train instructions and stuff like that, rather than teaching people a subject. You train people to repeat stuff back you either punish them or you reward them. You don't train them to critically think. You don't train them to actually examine a subject. You just get them to ingest facts. And he invented a thing called a Skinner box. And there's certain things that are talked about a Skinner box that aren't strictly true. Like some people say that he put his kid in there and she committed suicide. That's not actually true. But what he did do is it's the concept of rats in mazes, where they'll click on a lever, and the first time they'll get a pellet of food, the second time they'll get an electrocution, the third time they'll get a pellet of food, the fourth time they'll get nothing. Now, what's strange is at that time when they get nothing, rather than go, all right, whatever, and give up, they'll start pressing it really, really rapidly, because they'd have an easy pleasure before. And so people essentially, they go for easy pleasures because life's really hard, and like, you know, it's difficult and you've never done it before, like, you know, so it's everything's new. People will put up with a surprising amount of discomfort for easy pleasures on the basis that it's not great, but it's not bad, and it could be worse, so I'm just gonna hedge my bets and just stick to this and not, you know, put my head over the precipice, because God knows what's out there. And then what sort of informs this is the concept of the culture industry, which is another Frankfurt School thing. Well, essentially it's a Tavistock thing, really, but it came from Adorno and Horkheimer, and they likened culture to a factory churning out easy reproductions and you know, spitting it out, and easy but not very satisfying pleasures that people actually go for, and this sort of lowers the tone. And an example of that is the X Factor. Or, you know, the bafflingly titled America's Got Talent. Because these are just, they're not very good singers doing covers of not very good songs. And so you're getting the same stuff pumped out again and again and again. And aside from the business cases, I mean, that's one of the biggest cons of the radio industry, is that you put out a single and it gets played on the radio. Okay, because you're famous. The more it gets played, the more money you get from the PRS. The more it gets played, the more copies are sold, so the more money you get. The more copies get sold, the more it has to get played on the radio. And so it's this cyclical thing where essentially that's how all of a sudden artists are huge, because they're just, I mean, it used to be called payola and the mafia.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Organize it, and, you know, before that, it was jukebox wars and stuff like that. But this still goes on. It's just on a corporate level. That's why people are very, very successful. I mean, you've got to look at certain people. I mean, again, I'm not criticizing anybody's tastes and such, but you look at certain artists and go, they're all right. They've got catchy songs, but they didn't write the songs. So what is it that's particular about this person? Why is this person being pushed?
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the time it's because essentially they're malleable, because for that kiss of the brass ring, they'll do whatever, they'll wear whatever, they'll listen to their stylist and they'll listen to their manager, and they won't go, you know what, I want to make a political statement about the treatment of people in Guantanamo Bay. No, they're not going to do that. They're
going to be controlled. If you're in a position where you can speak to millions and you have admirers and everything else, you know, you could, there's been cases of that in the past, as you know, Neil, that they speak up or something, you know, and then they're gone.
Well, and people would go, like, artists will go, oh, it's rubbish. I say what the hell I like. Yeah, okay, fair enough. I'll give you an example. Go on Letterman and say, investigate 9/11. Well, I'm not going to do that. Why? Well, it's career suicide. So you're not going to do what you want. And I understand that because, again, it's a structure that is in place. If you want to say things like investigate 9/11, you've got to appreciate that you're probably not getting sponsored by Nike. But, you know, do you want to get sponsored by Nike? Again, it's another construct. They essentially have slave labor. And, you know, it's not a nice corporation.
Let me ask you this then. What is it? I mean, people want to, they want to belong, the majority of people. They want to fit in. When you're born into the world, you're hardwired to try to figure out what to do, how to behave, how to act, all these things, right? But what is it in our psychology, that our processes, that actually makes us then eventually say no, if you will, taking back that power of making the decisions for yourself and instead of going to external sources?
Well, I think it just has to come from examining it and going to the point where you go, you know what's not for me. Because it's like you say, we are hardwired to be in tribes and stuff like that. And social information is vital. In experiments, like, they'll give chimpanzees, you can go into one of two rooms. One of the rooms has got food in, the other room has got a picture of the alpha male of the tribe. But if you go in there, you can't have any food at all today. 99% of the time, they'll go and look at the picture. And that sounds barking mad, but basically you can get valuable information from watching or observing successful people.
Survival, that's what this is about.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so basically, if you're watching Kim Kardashian on the television, you're going, all right, okay, she's done pretty well for herself.
This is how I'm going to make it.
Yeah, if I can be a little bit like her, then maybe I can be a little bit like her. And that's why people do that.
Oh God!
You don't have to. There will be some people that say, well, the only way is you've got to get off the grid and you've got to go and live in a forest and you can't drink Coca-Cola and you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do that. And again, I'd say that no. Life is hard enough. You know, if you like a Coca-Cola or a beer every now and again, have a Coca-Cola or a beer. You know, don't become a shareholder in that company, but you know, don't beat yourself up about it, because that's one of the fundamental things. That's one of the fundamental control systems. There's two things: fear, which we've discussed, and then fear as it is in advertising and such like that, where basically if you don't get, I'll give you an example, like aftershave. You get this aftershave, look, there's a beautiful woman in a bikini on the aftershave thing, so if I get that aftershave, maybe I'll get a woman like that. But what your brain's going is, okay, well, logically then, if I don't have that aftershave, I'll never get a woman like that. And so that's the fear that you know, insurance companies sell it on the premise of, you don't want to die and leave your loved ones like rotting in a ditch, do you? You're not a monster, are you? And it's all that sort of tone. And so, you know, the fear of things really, really sort of seeps into you, basically. And
And how do you see that people override that fear? Again, if this is a process that happens unconsciously primarily, and that this, if this then is hardwired this way because of, you know, survival and instincts kind of thing, that those persons who've done well for themselves in the, you know, quote unquote tribe, you know, they're the ones who have probably doing something right. So you just let's observe them and just kind of figure it out, right? But today,
the other point is that basically it's this schism that we talked about, the sort of fact that there's something missing in my life. Perhaps I can fill it with products, and you know, that's the keeping up with the Joneses idea. And so those two concepts together are very, very, very powerful. So somehow what you've got to do is you've got to fill that schism with something else. And it's a twofold thing. A, don't be afraid, because that's basically the whole point. B, give yourself a break. You know, just be nice to yourself, right? That's really forgotten in today's society, is that basically be nice to yourself. It's often thought about that, you know, be good to others and stuff, and that is absolutely true. But, you know, give yourself a break, you know, because you're the only person that's really on your side. So
sure.
Give yourself a break. And then the other thing is, you know, find other things to do rather than products. And it doesn't mean that you have to give up PlayStation and going to the movies and doing all this and listening to music and stuff like that, because, hey, these are the things that make life interesting. But go for a walk, read a book, learn a musical instrument. Go and see your friends. Don't talk to your friends on Facebook. Go and spend time and interact with your friends and you know, get off your mobile phone. That would be my advice.
Well, exactly. And a lot of the way this have happened and formulated as well is that the spiritual void that many people feel, the emptiness, of course, is trying to be filled, and as you say, with certain external, you know, things that are available to you. And that's why you see in a lot of the ad campaigns as well that they have, I mean, Apple are playing like on this. We posted an article the other day, and there's a book written about this now called Appletopia, which basically shows that they're playing on the religious themes. I mean, for Christ's sake, the building in New York, the shop, the store, is, according to one of these sources here, the most photographed building in all of New York. So people actually come to it and take their photo in front of it like it's a cathedral. Wow. And I mean, there's just so much more to how they played on this. But basically what that shows is that people have a need, if you will, for some kind of, you know, higher source for something. And it seems like these products have been able to fill this kind of spiritual void, if you will.
Well, people fall in love with the phones. That's very, very glib. I'm being absolutely 100% serious. I'm just trying to find the actual study. Essentially, it was at Harvard or something like that. And when they showed people images of their iPhones or the ringtone, you know, the whatever the Apple ringtone is or something like that, people reacted by boosting out dopamine, serotonin, and the parts of the synapses of the brains that were reacting was the parts that happen when people are in love.
Okay, let me ask. Sorry, hold that thought, but just let me interject this quickly. Okay, is that then because the iPhone represents the connectivity that you get with it through to your other, you know, friends and family? Could it be something like that that's at the root of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is one of the problems with certain social media and smartphones and such like that. I mean, for a start, they're supposed to be a stress saving device, and they actually increase stress. I mean, everybody probably has the first sign that you're basically falling in love with your phone. This is going to sound crazy. Is getting a phantom buzz when you think, "Oh, did my phone just go off?" And you check it and pull it out of your pocket and stuff like that. It's been medically proven that this is a stress thing, and it's almost like jonesing for heroin, if you know what
right.
I mean. Like you're going, "Oh, come on, come on, come on, come on." And as we said, like, you know, social media and interaction gives you that vital information. So any form of social interaction like that, you could take it on board as being being sort of vital information.
So it's interesting as we're talking about this, because some of the pieces of the puzzle are falling in place. This is also then, in a way, Neil, indicative of the phone or whatever you have to maintain this contact is basically your hardwire to the hive, if you will.
Yeah,
collective,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I've just found this quote, actually. In each instance, the results showed activation in both the audio and visual cortices of the subjects' brains. In other words, when they were exposed to the video, our subjects' brains didn't just see the vibrating iPhone, they heard it too. And when they were exposed to the audio, they also saw it. This is a powerful cross-sensory phenomenon known as synesthesia.
Yeah.
Most striking of all was the flurry of activation in the insular cortex of the brain, which is associated with feelings of love and compassion. The subjects' brains responded to the sound of their phones as they would respond to the presence or proximity of a girlfriend, boyfriend, or close family member.
Yeah.
In short, the subjects didn't demonstrate the classic brain-based signs of addiction. Instead, they loved their iPhones. And just to go back to social media, social media is addictive in the same way that gambling is addictive, in the way that basically social information is rewarding. That's the way you gamble on Facebook. You put down a piece of information, you post, like, I forget what they're called, I don't know what they're called. You put your thing on your headlines or something like that. That's like putting down chips, Do you know what I mean? Big stakes. And you're either going to win because people are going to respond to you, or you're going to lose and then you're going to have to gamble again. And every time you gamble again and lose, you feel a bit worse. And I'll take it a step further. Everybody, and I've had people, not me, everybody modifies what they put on Facebook. Just by the definition of you can't get 24 hours of information onto your like post or whatever it's called. You can't, and you don't put stuff like, oh, I had a really embarrassing incident at the toilet today, and oh, I did this, and you know, whatever you put on it, you put it in a way that is socially acceptable and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't go, you know what, I really lost it this morning, and I made a horrible comment to a little kid, and I don't know why I did it, I just did, and never mind. You'd never put something like that on there. Like, so you're modifying this thing. So the version of you on Facebook, it's a sleeker, better marketed version of you, right? Okay? And sooner or later, your subconscious is going to go, hang on, this version of me is more popular than me. This version of me has got 700 friends. I only interact with 5 people on a regular basis. That's ridiculous. And so you'll start to change yourself to be more like the person on Facebook. I'll take it a step further. Everybody lies on Facebook. Everybody puts the most glamorous photo up there, tries to express the most fun that they're having on in their life. And so if you're there as a casual observer, you sat there going, my God, everyone's life's more exciting than mine. What can I do? Gamble. Gamble with social information, because then I can get information about how to be as exciting as these people, and then the cycle continues and continues and continues. Mm-hmm. I mean, social media is oxymoronical, because basically you're being less social. The more time you spend on social media, by definition, the less time you're spending interacting with a person. And the problem with talking to a person like without with a screen in between you, or over the internet, or even like we're talking now, Henrik Roke, okay, because I can't see your eyes and your reaction and stuff like that. It's the equivalent of wearing a mask, or sure, it's the equivalent of wearing dark sunglasses. And again, if people don't think that's stupid, go and look how people react in a riot situation just because they've got a mask on. Go and read the Zimbardo experiments where people put masks on and felt that they could be far ruder to people in public. Yeah. Or the very one is the Stanford prison experiment, whereby the guards were given reflective sunglasses, so which hid, you know, it provided the anonymity required for them to disassociate and take on the role of authoritarian.
And you see the worst enemy reflecting back to you in that mirror, your own self, right? So.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. But that's the point. I mean, it's a vicious cycle, whereby it's a doomed downward spiral of essentially misery, but it's disguised. Again, you can liken a lot of these things to heroin, because the first time that you do that, you're never going to get that again, but you're going to spend your entire life doing it until you run ragged and all your teeth have fallen out.
Okay, really good. Let's begin to wrap things up for the first segment here, Neil. It was very interesting, and we're going to continue, and I think we should really focus, get into the LSD, MKUltra, and hippie movement here in the second segment as we do so. But let's talk a little bit about your book for us. You have 2 volumes out. Your thoughts are not your own. Tell us a little bit about these, what they are involved and everything else, and then, of course, give us the website address so people know where to go to find more of your work, Neil.
Oh, certainly. Thank you. Well, the first volume is called Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, Mind Control, Mass Manipulation, and Perception Management. And the first volume deals with the history of MKUltra, the history of the LSD experiments, the doctors involved, the various types of mind control, drugs, hypnosis, psychotronics, the creation of Manchurian candidates, admitted Manchurian candidates, possible Manchurian candidates, school shootings, serial killers, and the connections to the Phoenix program, and so it's essentially the nuts and bolts of MKUltra. And then volume 2 is called Marketing, Movies, and Music, and it's more social control and the stuff that we've been talking about today: the use of the media, the use of movies, the use of social media, the tricks of the trade of advertising, how music can affect you, how colors can affect you. And then I delve into the music industry and the creation of the East Coast rivalry in hip-hop, the pushing of certain pop artists, and then it winds up talking about the LSD explosion, the Laurel Canyon, the hippies, and that, because I essentially believe that that entire thing was a social experiment.
Very interesting. Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com, that's your main website. You have a bunch of videos on there. People can, of course, pick up copies of the book right there, I believe.
Yes, they can. They're both available there. And also I'm on Facebook, which is slightly strange because I've just spent 20 minutes deriding it. But yeah. But, you know, it's a way for people to get in contact with me if they so wish.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, we're going to tie in the 60s movement here in the second hour. MKUltra, mind control, LSD experimentation and everything else. So stay with us, Neil. We'll be right back with more. Thank you for this first segment. We'll see you on the other side.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. Picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room.
I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. Vibrations are happening.